for which I ought to apologise, did I?" he suddenly blurted out. Sophie spat the ham out into her napkin. "I'll take that as a yes," he muttered.
"No," she said quickly, "not at all. You merely startled me."
His eyes narrowed. "You wouldn't lie to me about this, would you?" Sophie shook her head as she remembered the single, perfect kiss she'd given him. He hadn't done anything that required an apology, but that didn't mean that she hadn't. "You're blushing," he accused.
"No, I'm not."
"Yes," he said, "you are."
"If I'm blushing," she replied pertly, "it's because I'm wondering why you would think you had any reason to apologise."
"You have a rather smart mouth for a servant," he said.
"I'm sorry,"
Sophie said quickly. She had to remember her place. But that was hard to do with this man, the one member of the Ton who had treated her, if only for a few hours, as an equal. "I meant it as a compliment," he said. "Do not stifle yourself on my account." She said nothing. "I find you rather..." He paused, obviously searching for the correct word. "Refreshing."
"Oh," she set her fork down. "Thank you."
"Have you plans for the rest of the day?" he asked. She looked down at her huge garments and grimaced.
"I thought I'd wait for my clothes to be readied, and then I suppose I'll see if any of the nearby houses are in need of housemaids."
Benedict scowled at her. "I told you I would find you a position with my mother."
"And I do appreciate that," she said quickly, "but I would prefer to stay in the country."
He shrugged the shrug of one who has never been thrown one of life's great stumbles. "You can work at Aubrey Hall, then, in Kent." Sophie chewed on her lower lip. She couldn't exactly come out and say she didn't want to work for his mother because then she'd have to see him. She couldn't think of a torture that would be more exquisitely painful.
"You shouldn't think of me as your responsibility," she finally said.
He gave her a rather superior glance. "I told you I would find you a new position."
"But
what could there possibly be to discuss?"
"Nothing," she grumbled. "Nothing at all."
Clearly, it was no use arguing with him just then. "Good." He leaned back contentedly against his pillows. "I'm glad you see it my way." Sophie stood.
"I should be going."
"To do what?" She felt rather stupid as she said,
"I don't know."
He grinned. "Have fun with it, then."
Her hand tightened around the handle of the serving spoon.
"Don't do it," he warned.
"Do what?"
"Throw the spoon."
"I wouldn't dream of it,"
she said tightly. He laughed aloud. "Oh, yes, you would. You're dreaming of it right now. You just wouldn't do it."
Sophie's hand was gripping the spoon so hard it shook. Benedict was chuckling so hard his bed shook. Sophie stood, still holding the spoon.
Benedict smiled. "Are you planning to take that with you?"
"Remember your place," Sophie was screaming at herself. "Remember your place."
"Whatever could you be thinking," Benedict mused, "to look so adorably ferocious? No, don't tell me," he added. "I'm sure it involves my untimely and painful demise."
Slowly and carefully, Sophie turned her back to him and put the spoon down on the table. She didn't want to risk any sudden movements. One false move, and she knew she'd be hurling it at his head.
Benedict raised his brows approvingly. "That was very mature of you."
Sophie turned around slowly.
"Are you this charming with everyone, or only me?"
"Oh, only you," he grinned. "I shall have to make sure you take me up on my offer to find you employment with my mother. You do bring out the best in me, Miss Sophie Beckett."
"This is the best?"
she asked with obvious disbelief.
"I'm afraid so."
Sophie just shook her head as she walked to the door. Conversations with Benedict Bridgerton could be exhausting.
"Oh, Sophie!" he called out.
She turned around. He smiled slyly.
"I knew you wouldn't throw the spoon."
What happened next was surely not Sophie's fault. She was convinced, temporarily and fleetingly possessed by a demon, because she absolutely did not recognise the hand that shot out to the small table next to her and picked up a stump of a candle. True, the hand appeared to be connected quite firmly to her arm, but it didn't look the least bit familiar as it drew back and hurled the stump across the room, straight at Benedict Bridgerton's head. Sophie didn't even wait to see if her aim had been true. But as she stalked out the door, she heard Benedict explode with laughter. Then she heard him shout out, "Well done, Miss Beckett!" And she realised that for the first time in years, her smile was one of pure, unadulterated joy. Chapter 10. Although he responded in the affirmative, or so says Lady Covington, Benedict Bridgerton did not make an appearance at the annual Covington ball. Complaints were heard from young women and their mamas across the ballroom. According to Lady Bridgerton, his mother, not his sister-in-law, Mr. Bridgerton left for the country last week and has not been heard from since. Those who might fear for Mr. Bridgerton's health and well-being should not fret. Lady Bridgerton sounded more annoyed than worried. Last year, no less than 4 couples met their future spouses at the Covington Ball. The previous year, 3. Much to Lady Bridgerton's dismay, if any matches are made at this year's Covington Ball, her son Benedict will not be among the grooms. Lady Whistledown's Society Papers, 5th of May, 1817. There were advantages, Benedict soon discovered, to a long, drawn-out recovery. The most obvious was the quantity and variety of most excellent food brought forth from Mrs. Crabtree's kitchen. He'd always been fed well at My Cottage, but Mrs. Crabtree truly rose to the occasion when she had someone tucked away in the sick room. And even better, Mr. Crabtree had managed to intercept all of Mrs. Crabtree's tonics and replace them with Benedict's best brandy. Benedict dutifully drank every drop, but the last time he looked out the window, it appeared that 3 of his rose bushes had died, presumably where Mr. Crabtree had dumped the tonic. It was a sad sacrifice, but one Benedict was more than willing to make after his last experience with Mrs. Crabtree's tonics. Another perk of staying abed was the simple fact that, for the first time in years, he could enjoy some quiet time. He read, sketched, and even closed his eyes and just daydreamed, all without feeling guilty for neglecting some other task or chore. Benedict soon decided that he'd be perfectly happy leading the life of the indolent. But the best part of his recovery, by far, was Sophie. She popped into his room several times a day, sometimes to fluff his pillows, sometimes to bring him food, sometimes just to read to him. Benedict had a feeling that her industriousness was due to her desire to feel useful, and to thank him with deeds for saving her from Philip Cavender. But he didn't much care why she came to visit. He just liked it that she did. She'd been quiet and reserved at first, obviously trying to adhere to the standard that servants should be neither seen nor heard. But Benedict had had none of that, and he'd purposefully engaged her in conversation, just so she couldn't leave, or he'd goad and needle her, simply to get a rise out of her, because he liked her far better when she was spitting fire than when she was meek and submissive. But mostly, he just enjoyed being in the same room with her. It didn't seem to matter if they were talking or if she was just sitting in a chair, leafing through a book, while he stared out the window. Something about her presence brought him peace. A sharp knock at the door broke him out of his thoughts, and he looked up eagerly, calling out, "Enter!" Sophie poked her head in. her shoulder-length curls shaking slightly as they brushed against the edge of the door.
"Mrs. Crabtree thought you might like tea."
"Tea? Or tea and biscuits?"
Sophie grinned, pushing the door open with her hip as she balanced the tray.
"Oh, the latter, to be sure."
"Excellent. And will you join me?"
She hesitated, as she always did, but then she nodded, as she also always did. She'd long since learned that there was no arguing with Benedict when he had his mind set on something. Benedict rather liked it that way.
"The colour is back in your cheeks,"
she commented, as she set the tray down on a nearby table.
"And you don't look nearly so tired. I should think you'll be up and out of bed soon."
"Oh, soon, I'm sure,"
he said evasively.
"You're looking healthier every day."
He smiled gamely.
"Do you think so?"
She lifted the teapot and paused before she poured.
"Yes,"
she said with an ironic smile.
"I wouldn't have said so otherwise."
Benedict watched her hands as she prepared his tea. She moved with an innate sense of grace, and she poured the tea as if she'd been to the manor born. Clearly, the art of afternoon tea had been another one of those lessons she'd learned from her mother's generous employers. Or maybe she'd just watched other ladies closely while they'd prepared tea. Benedict had noticed that she was a very observant woman. They'd enacted this ritual often enough that she didn't have to ask how he liked his tea. She handed him his cup, milk, no sugar, and then placed a selection of biscuits and scones on a plate.
"Fix yourself a cup," Benedict said, biting into a biscuit, "and come sit by me."
She hesitated again. He knew she'd hesitate, even though she'd already agreed to join him. But he was a patient man, and his patience was rewarded with a soft sigh as she reached out and plucked another cup off the tray. After she'd fixed her own cup, two lumps of sugar, just the barest splash of milk, she sat in the velvet-covered, straight-backed chair by his bed, regarding him over the rim of her teacup as she took a sip.
"No biscuits for you?" Benedict asked.
She shook her head.
"I had a few straight out of the oven."
"Lucky you. They're always best when they're warm."
He polished off another biscuit, brushed a few crumbs off of his sleeve, and reached for another.
"And how have you spent your day?"
"Since I last saw you 2 hours earlier."
Benedict shot her a look that said he recognised her sarcasm, but chose not to respond to it.
"I helped Mrs. Crabtree in the kitchen," Sophie said. "She's making a beef stew for supper, and needed some potatoes peeled. Then I borrowed a book from your library and read in the garden."
"Really? What did you read?"
"A novel."
"Was it good?"
She shrugged.
"Silly, but romantic. I enjoyed it."
"And do you long for romance?"
Her blush was instantaneous.
"That's a rather personal question, don't you think?"
Benedict shrugged and started to say something utterly flip, like, "It was worth a try." But as he watched her face, her cheeks turning delightfully pink, her eyes cast down to her lap, the strangest thing happened. He realised he wanted her. He really, really wanted her. He wasn't certain why this so surprised him. Of course he wanted her. He was as red-blooded as any man, and one couldn't spend a protracted amount of time around a woman as gamine and adorable as Sophie without wanting her. Hell, he wanted half the women he met, in a purely low-intensity, non-urgent sort of way. But in that moment, with this woman, it became urgent. Benedict changed positions. Then he bunched the coverlet up over his lap. Then he changed positions again.
"Is your bed uncomfortable?" Sophie asked. "Do you need me to fluff your pillows?"
Benedict's first urge was to reply in the affirmative, grab her as she leaned across him, and then have his wicked way with her, since they would, rather conveniently, be in bed. But he had a sneaking suspicion that that particular plan would not go over well with Sophie. So instead he said,
"I'm fine.
then winced when he realized his voice sounded oddly squeaky. She smiled as she eyed the biscuits on his plate, saying,
"Maybe just one more."
Benedict moved his arm out of the way to allow her easy access to his plate, which was, he realized somewhat belatedly, resting on his lap. The sight of her hand reaching toward his groin, even if she was aiming for a plate of biscuits, did funny things to him. To his groin, to be precise. Benedict had a sudden vision of things shifting down there, and he hastily grabbed the plate lest it become unbalanced.
"Do you mind if I take the last?"
"Fine," he croaked. She plucked a ginger biscuit off the plate and frowned.
"You look better,"
she said, giving the biscuit a little sniff.
"But you don't sound better. Is your throat bothering you?"
Benedict took a quick sip of his tea. "Not at all. I must have swallowed a piece of dust."
"Oh, drink some more tea then. That shouldn't bother you for long."
She set her teacup down.
"Would you like me to read to you?"
"Yes," Benedict said quickly, bunching up his coverlet around his waist. She might try to take away the strategically placed plate, and then where would he be?
"Are you certain you're all right?"
she asked, looking far more suspicious than concerned. He smiled tightly. "Just fine."
"Very well,"
she said, standing up.
"What would you like me to read?"
"Oh, anything," he said, with a blithe wave of his hand.
"Poetry?"
"Splendid." He would have said splendid had she offered to read a dissertation on botany in the Arctic tundra. Sophie wandered over to a recessed bookshelf and idly perused its contents.
"Byron?"
she asked.
"Blake?"
"Blake," he said quite firmly. An hour's worth of Byron's romantic drivel would probably send him quite over the edge. She slid a slim volume of poetry off the shelf and returned to her chair, swishing her rather unattractive skirts before she sat down. Benedict frowned. He'd never really noticed before how ugly her dress was. Not as bad as the one Mrs. Crabtree had lent her, but certainly not anything designed to bring out the best in a woman. He ought to buy her a new dress. She would never accept it, of course, but maybe if her current garments were accidentally burned.
"Mr. Bridgerton?"
But how could he manage to burn her dress? She'd have to not be wearing it, and that posed a certain challenge in and of itself.
"Are you even listening to me?"
Sophie demanded.
"Hmm?"
"You're not listening to me."
Sorry, he admitted. "My apologies. My mind got away from me. Please continue." She began anew, and in his attempt to show how much attention he was paying her, he focused his eyes on her lips, which proved to be a big mistake. Because suddenly those lips were all he could see, and he couldn't stop thinking about kissing her, and he knew, absolutely knew, that if one of them didn't leave the room in the next 30 seconds, he was going to do something for which he'd owe her 1,000 apologies. Not that he didn't plan to seduce her, just that he'd rather do it with a bit more finesse.
"Oh, dear,"
he blurted out. Sophie gave him an odd look. He didn't blame her. He sounded like a complete idiot. He didn't think he'd uttered the phrase, "Oh, dear," in years, if ever. Hell, he sounded like his mother.
"Is something wrong?"
Sophie asked.
"I just remembered something,"
he said rather stupidly, in his opinion. She raised her brows in question.
"Something that I'd forgotten," Benedict said.
"The things one remembers,"
she said, looking exceedingly amused,
"are most often things one had forgotten."
He scowled at her.
"I'll need a bit of privacy."
She stood instantly.
"Of course,"
she murmured. Benedict fought off a groan. Damn, she looked hurt. He hadn't meant to injure her feelings. He just needed to get her out of the room so that he didn't yank her into the bed.
"It's a personal matter,"
he told her, trying to make her feel better, but suspecting that all he was doing was making himself look like a fool.
"Oh," she said knowingly, "would you like me to bring you the chamber pot?"
"I can walk to the chamber pot,"
he retorted, forgetting that he didn't need to use the chamber pot. She nodded and stood, setting the book of poetry onto a nearby table.
"I'll leave you to your business. Just ring the bell pull when you need me."
"I'm not going to summon you like a servant," he growled.
"But I am..."
"Not for me, you're not," he said.
The words emerged a little more harshly than was necessary, but he'd always detested men who preyed on helpless female servants. The thought that he might be turning into one of those repellent creatures was enough to make him gag.
"Very well,"
she said, her words meek, like a servant. Then she nodded like a servant. He was fairly certain she did it just to annoy him, and left. The minute she was gone, Benedict leapt out of the bed and ran to the window. Good. No one was in sight. He shrugged off his dressing gown, replaced it with a pair of breeches and a shirt and jacket, and looked out the window again. Good. Still no one. "Boots, boots," he muttered, glancing around the room. Where the hell were his boots? Not his good boots, the pair for mucking around in the mud. Ah, there they were. He grabbed the boots and yanked them on. Back to the window. Still no one. Excellent. Benedict threw one leg over the sill, then another, then grabbed hold of the long, sturdy branch that jutted out from a nearby elm tree. From there, it was an easy shimmy, wiggle, and balancing act down to the ground. And from there, it was straight to the lake, to the very cold lake, to take a very cold swim.
"If he needed the chamber pot," Sophie muttered to herself, "he could have just said so. It's not as if I haven't fetched chamber pots before."
She stamped down the stairs to the main floor, not entirely certain why she was going downstairs. She had nothing specific to do there, but heading in that direction simply because she couldn't think of anything better to do. She didn't understand why he had so much trouble treating her like what she was, a servant. He kept insisting that she didn't work for him and didn't have to do anything to earn her keep at My Cottage, and then, in the same breath, assured her that he would find her a position in his mother's household. If he would just treat her like a servant, she'd have no trouble remembering that she was an illegitimate nobody, and he was a member of one of the Ton's wealthiest and most influential families. Every time he treated her like a real person, and it was her experience that most aristocrats did not treat servants like anything remotely approaching a real person, it brought her back to the night of the masquerade, when she'd been, for one perfect evening, a lady of glamour and grace, the sort of woman who had a right to dream about her future with Benedict Bridgerton. He acted as if he actually liked her and enjoyed her company. And maybe he did. But that was the cruelest twist of all, because he was making her love him, making a small part of her think she had the right to dream about him. And then, inevitably, she had to remind herself of the truth of the situation, and it hurt so damned much.
"Oh, there you are, Miss Sophie."
Sophie lifted up her eyes, which had been absently following the cracks in the parquet floor, to see Mrs. Crabtree descending the stairs behind her.
"Good day, Mrs. Crabtree," Sophie said. "How is that beef stew coming along?"
"Fine, fine," Mrs. Crabtree said absently. "We were a bit short on carrots, but I think it will be tasty nonetheless. Have you seen Mr. Bridgerton?"
Sophie blinked in surprise at the question.
"In his room, just a minute ago."
"Well, he's not there now."
"I think he had to use the chamber pot."
Mrs. Crabtree didn't even blush. It was the sort of conversation servants often had about their employers.
"Well, if he did use it, he didn't use it, if you know what I mean," she said. "The room smelled as fresh as a spring day."
Sophie frowned.
"And he wasn't there?"
Neither hide nor hair.
I can't imagine where he might have gone.
Mrs. Crabtree planted her hands on her ample hips.
I'll search the downstairs and you search the up. One of us is bound to find him.
I'm not sure that's such a good idea, Mrs. Crabtree. If he's left his room, he probably had a good reason. Most likely he doesn't want to be found.
But he's ill,
Mrs. Crabtree protested. Sophie considered that, then pictured his face in her mind. His skin had held a healthy glow, and he hadn't looked the least bit tired.
I'm not so certain about that, Mrs. Crabtree, she finally said. I think he's malingering on purpose.
Don't be silly, Mrs. Crabtree scoffed. Mr. Bridgerton would never do something like that.
Sophie shrugged.
I wouldn't have thought so, but truly, he doesn't look the least bit ill any longer.
It's my tonics, Mrs. Crabtree said with a confident nod. I told you they'd speed up his recovery.
Sophie had seen Mr. Crabtree dump the tonics in the rose bushes. She'd also seen the aftermath. It hadn't been a pretty sight. How she managed to smile and nod, she'd never know.
Well, I, for one, would like to know where he went, Mrs. Crabtree continued. He shouldn't be out of bed, and he knows it.
I'm sure he'll return soon, Sophie said placatingly. In the meantime, do you need any help in the kitchen?
Mrs. Crabtree shook her head.
No, no. All that stew needs to do now is cook. And besides, Mr. Bridgerton has been scolding me for allowing you to work.
But no arguments, if you please,
Mrs. Crabtree cut in.
He's right, of course. You're a guest here, and you shouldn't have to lift a finger.
I'm not a guest, Sophie protested.
Well, then, what are you?
That gave Sophie pause.
I have no idea, she finally said. But I'm definitely not a guest. A guest would be...
She struggled to make sense of her thoughts and feelings.
I suppose a guest would be someone who is of the same social rank, or at least close to it. A guest would be someone who has never had to wait upon another person, or scrub floors, or empty chamber pots. A guest would be
anyone the master of the house chooses to invite as a guest,
Mrs. Crabtree retorted.
That's the beauty of being the master of the house. You can do anything you please, and you should stop belittling yourself. If Mr. Bridgerton chooses to regard you as a house guest, then you should accept his judgment and enjoy yourself. When was the last time you were able to live in comfort without having to work your fingers to the bone in return?
He can't truly regard me as a house guest,
Sophie said quietly.
If he did, he would have installed a chaperone for the protection of my reputation.
As if I would allow anything untoward in my house, Mrs. Crabtree bristled.
Of course you wouldn't,
Sophie assured her.
But where reputations are at stake, appearance is just as important as fact. And in the eyes of society, a housekeeper does not qualify as a chaperone, no matter how strict and pure her morals may be.
If that's true, Mrs. Crabtree protested, then you need a chaperone, Miss Sophie.
Don't be silly. I don't need a chaperone because I'm not of his class. No one cares if a housemaid lives and works in the household of a single man. No one thinks any less of her, and certainly no one who would consider her for marriage would consider her ruined.
Sophie shrugged.
It's the way of the world. And obviously it's the way Mr. Bridgerton thinks, whether he'll admit it or not, because he has never once said a word about it being improper for me to be here.
Well, I don't like it, Mrs. Crabtree announced. I don't like it one bit.
Sophie just smiled, because it was so sweet of the housekeeper to care.
I think I'm going to take myself off for a walk, she said, as long as you're certain you don't need any help in the kitchen. And,
she added with a sly grin,
as long as I'm in this strange, hazy position, I might not be a guest, but it is the first time in years I'm not a servant, and I'm going to enjoy my free time while it lasts.
Mrs. Crabtree gave her a hearty pat on the shoulder.
You do that, Miss Sophie, and pick a flower for me while you're out there.
Sophie grinned and headed out the front door. It was a lovely day, unseasonably warm and sunny, and the air held the gentle fragrance of the first blooms of spring. She couldn't recall the last time she'd taken a walk for the simple pleasure of enjoying the fresh air. Benedict had told her about a nearby pond, and she thought she might amble that way, maybe even dip her toes in the water, if she was feeling particularly daring. She smiled up at the sun. The air might be warm, but the water was surely still freezing, so early in May. Still, it would feel good. Anything felt good that represented leisure time and peaceful, solitary moments. She paused for a moment, frowning thoughtfully at the horizon. Benedict had mentioned that the lake was south of my cottage, hadn't he? A southward route would take her right through a rather densely wooded patch, but a bit of a hike certainly wouldn't kill her. Sophie picked her way through the forest, stepping over tree roots and pushing aside low-lying branches, letting them snap back behind her with reckless abandon. The sun barely squeaked through the canopy of leaves above her, and down at ground level it felt more like dusk than midday. Up ahead she could see a clearing, which she assumed must be the pond. As she drew closer, she saw the glint of sunlight on water, and she breathed a little sigh of satisfaction, happy to know that she'd gone in the correct direction. But as she drew even closer, she heard the sound of someone splashing about, and she realized, with equal parts terror and curiosity, that she was not alone. She was only 10 or so feet from the edge of the pond, easily visible to anyone in the water, so she quickly flattened herself behind the trunk of a large oak. If she had a sensible bone in her body, she'd turn right around and run back to the house. But she just couldn't quite keep herself from peeking around the tree and looking to see who might be mad enough to splash about in a lake so early in the season. With slow, silent movements, she crept out from behind the tree, trying to keep as much of herself concealed as possible. And she saw a man. A naked man. A naked Benedict?
Chapter 11. The housemaid wars rage on in London. Lady Penwood called Mrs. Featherington a conniving, ill-bred thief in front of no less than 3 society matrons, including the very popular Dowager Viscountess Bridgerton. Mrs. Featherington responded by calling Lady Penwood's home no better than a workhouse, citing the ill treatment of her lady's maid, whose name, this author has learned, is not Estelle, as was originally claimed, and furthermore she is not remotely French. The girl's name is Bess, and she hails from Liverpool. Lady Penwood stalked away from the altercation in quite a huff, followed by her daughter, Miss Rosamond Riling. Lady Penwood's other daughter, Posy, who was wearing an unfortunate green gown, remained behind, with a somewhat apologetic look in her eyes, until her mother returned, grabbed her by the sleeve, and dragged her off. This author certainly does not make up the guest lists at society parties, but it is difficult to imagine that the Penwoods will be invited to Mrs. Featherington's next soiree. Lady Whistledown's Society Papers, 7th of May, 1817. It was wrong of her to stay. So wrong. So very, very wrong. And yet she did not move an inch. She found a large, bald-pated rock, mostly obscured by a short, squat bush, and sat down, never once taking her eyes off of him. He was naked. She still couldn't quite believe it. He was, of course, partially submerged, with the edge of the water rippling against his ribcage. The lower, she thought giddily, edge of his ribcage. Or perhaps, if she were to be honest with herself, she'd have to rephrase her previous thought to, he was, unfortunately, partially submerged. Sophie was as innocent as the next, as, well, the next innocent, but dash it all, she was curious.
and she was more than halfway in love with this man.
Was it so very wicked to wish for a huge gust of wind, powerful enough to create a small tidal wave that would whip the water away from his body and deposit it somewhere else? Anywhere else? Very well, it was wicked. She was wicked, and she didn't care. She'd spent her life taking the safe road, the prudent path. Only one night in her short life had she completely thrown caution to the wind, and that night had been the most thrilling, the most magical, the most stupendously wonderful night of her life. And so she decided to remain right where she was, stay the course, and see what she saw. It wasn't as if she had anything to lose. She had no job, no prospects, save for Benedict's promise to find her a position in his mother's household, and she had a feeling that would be a very bad idea anyway. And so she sat back, tried not to move a muscle, and kept her eyes wide, wide open. Benedict had never been a superstitious man, and he'd certainly never thought himself the sort with a sixth sense. But once or twice in his life, he'd experienced a strange surge of awareness, a sort of mystical tingling feeling that warned him that something important was afoot. The first time had been the day his father had died. He'd never told anyone about this, not even his older brother Anthony, who'd been utterly devastated by their father's death. But that afternoon, as he and Anthony had raced across the fields of Kent in some silly horse race, he'd felt an odd, numb feeling in his arms and legs, followed by the strangest pounding in his head. It hadn't hurt, precisely, but it had sucked the air from his lungs and left him with the most intense sensation of terror he could ever imagine. He'd lost the race, of course. It was difficult to grip reins when one's fingers refused to work properly. And when he'd returned home, he'd discovered that his terror had not been unwarranted. His father was already dead, having collapsed after being stung by a bee. Benedict still had difficulty believing that a man as strong and vital as his father could be felled by a bee, but there had been no other explanation. The second time it had happened, however, the feeling had been completely different. It had been the night of his mother's masquerade, right before he'd seen the woman in the silver dress. Like the time before, the sensation had started in his arms and legs, but instead of feeling numb, this time he felt an odd tingling, as if he'd just suddenly come alive after years of sleepwalking. Then he'd turned and seen her, and he'd known she was the reason he was there that night, the reason he lived in England, hell, the very reason he'd been born. Of course, she had gone and proven him wrong by disappearing into thin air, but at the time, he'd believed all that, and if she'd let him, he would have proven it to her as well. Now, as he stood in the pond, the water lapping at his midriff, just above his navel, he was struck once again by that odd sense of somehow being more alive than he'd been just seconds earlier. It was a good feeling, an exciting, breathless rush of emotion. It was like before, when he'd met her. Something was about to happen. Or maybe someone was near. His life was about to change. And he was, he realized with a wry twist of his lips, naked as the day he was born. It didn't exactly put a man at an advantage, at least not unless he was in between a pair of silk sheets with an attractive young woman at his side, or underneath. He took a step into slightly deeper waters, the soft sludge of the pond bottom squishing between his toes. Now the water reached a couple of inches higher. He was bloody well freezing, but at least he was mostly covered up. He scanned the shore, looking up into trees and down in the bushes. There had to be someone there. Nothing else could account for the strange, tingling feeling that had now spread throughout his body. And if his body could tingle while submerged in a lake so cold, he was terrified to see his own privates. The poor things felt like they'd shrunk to nothing, which was not what a man liked to imagine. Then it must be a very strong tingle indeed.
"Who is out there?" he called out.
No answer. He hadn't really expected one, but it had been worth a try.
He squinted as he searched the shore again, turning a full 360 degrees as he watched for any sign of movement. He saw nothing but the gentle ruffling of the leaves in the wind, but as he finished his sweep of the area, he somehow knew.
"Sophie!"
He heard a gasp, followed by a huge flurry of activity.
"Sophie Beckett!" he yelled. "If you run from me right now, I swear I will follow you, and I will not take the time to don my clothing."
The noises coming from the shore slowed.
"I will catch up with you," he continued, "because I'm stronger and faster, and I might very well feel compelled to tackle you to the ground, just to be certain you do not escape."
The sounds of her movement ceased.
"Good," he grunted. "Show yourself."
She didn't.
"Sophie,"
he warned. There was a beat of silence, followed by the sound of slow, hesitant footsteps, and then he saw her, standing on the shore in one of those awful dresses he'd like to see sunk to the bottom of the Thames.
"What are you doing here?"
he demanded.
"I went for a walk. What are you doing here?" she countered. "You're supposed to be ill. That..."
she waved her arm toward him, and, by extension, the pond,
"can't possibly be good for you."
He ignored her question and comment.
"Were you following me?"
"Of course not,"
she replied, and he rather believed her. He didn't think she possessed the acting talents to fake that level of righteousness.
"I would never follow you to a swimming hole,"
she continued.
"It would be indecent."
And then her face went completely red, because they both knew she hadn't a leg to stand on with that argument. If she had truly been concerned about decency, she'd have left the pond the second she'd seen him, accidentally or not. He lifted one hand from the water and pointed toward her, twisting his wrist as he motioned for her to turn around.
"Give me your back while you wait for me," he ordered. "It will only take me a moment to pull on my clothing."
"I'll go home right now,"
she offered.
"You'll enjoy greater privacy and..."
"You'll stay,"
he said firmly.
"But..."
he crossed his arms.
"Do I look like a man in the mood to be argued with?"
She stared at him mutinously.
"If you run," he warned, "I will catch you."
Sophie eyed the distance between them, then tried to judge the distance back to my cottage. If he stopped to pull on his clothing, she might have a chance of escaping. But if he didn't...
"Sophie," he said, "I can practically see the steam coming out of your ears. Stop taxing your brain with useless mathematical computations and do as I asked."
One of her feet twitched. Whether it was itching to run home or merely turn around, she'd never know.
"Now," he ordered.
With a loud sigh and grumble, Sophie crossed her arms and turned around to stare at a knothole in the tree trunk in front of her, as if her very life depended on it. The infernal man wasn't being particularly quiet as he went about his business, and she couldn't seem to keep herself from listening to and trying to identify every sound that rustled and splashed behind her. Now he was emerging from the water. Now he was reaching for his breeches. Now he was... It was no use. She had a dreadfully wicked imagination, and there was no getting around it. He should have just let her return to the house. Instead, she was forced to wait, utterly mortified, while he dressed. Her skin felt like it was on fire, and she was certain her cheeks must be 8 different shades of red. A gentleman would have let her weasel out of her embarrassment and hole up in her room back at the house for at least 3 days in hopes that he'd just forget about the entire affair. But Benedict Bridgerton was obviously determined not to be a gentleman this afternoon, because when she moved one of her feet, just to flex her toes, which were falling asleep in her shoes, honest, barely half a second passed before he growled,
"Don't even think about it."
"I wasn't," she protested. "My foot was falling asleep. And hurry up. It can't possibly take so long to get dressed."
"Oh,"
he drawled.
"You're doing this just to torture me," she grumbled.
"You may feel free to face me at any time,"
he said, his voice laced with quiet amusement.
I assure you that I asked you to turn your back for the sake of your sensibilities, not mine.
I'm just fine where I am,
she replied. After what seemed like an hour, but what was probably only 3 minutes, she heard him say,
You may turn around now.
Sophie was almost afraid to do so. He had just the sort of perverse sense of humour that would compel him to order her around before he'd donned his clothing. But she decided to trust him. Not, she was forced to admit, that she had much choice in the matter. And so she turned around. Much to her relief, and, if she was to be honest with herself, a fair bit of disappointment, he was quite decently dressed, save for a smattering of damp spots where the water from his skin had seeped through the fabric of his clothing.
"Why didn't you just let me run home?"
she asked.
"I wanted you here,"
he said simply.
"But why?"
she persisted. He shrugged.
"I don't know. Punishment, perhaps, for spying on me."
"I wasn't."
Sophie's denial was automatic, but she cut herself off halfway through, because of course she'd been spying on him.
"Smart girl," he murmured.
She scowled at him. She would have liked to have said something utterly droll and witty, but she had a feeling that anything emerging from her mouth just then would have been quite the opposite. So she held her tongue. Better to be a silent fool than a talkative one.
"It's very bad form to spy on one's host,"
he said, planting his hands on his hips and somehow managing to look both authoritative and relaxed at the same time.
"It was an accident," she grumbled.
"Oh, I believe you there," he said. "But even if you didn't intend to spy on me, the fact remains that when the opportunity arose, you took it."
"Do you blame me?"
he grinned.
"Not at all. I would have done precisely the same thing."
Her mouth fell open.
"Oh, don't pretend to be offended,"
he said.
"I'm not pretending."
He leaned a bit closer.
"To tell the truth, I'm quite flattered."
"It was academic curiosity,"
she ground out.
"I assure you."
His smile grew sly.
"So you're telling me that you would have spied upon any naked man you'd come across?"
"Of course not."
"As I said,"
he drawled, leaning back against a tree, "I'm flattered."
"Well, now that we have that settled,"
Sophie said with a sniff,
"I'm going back to your cottage."
She made it only 2 steps before his hand shot out and grabbed a small measure of the fabric of her dress.
"I don't think so," he said.
Sophie turned back around with a weary sigh.
"You have already embarrassed me beyond repair. What more could you possibly wish to do to me?"
Slowly, he reeled her in.
"That's a very interesting question,"
he murmured. Sophie tried to plant her heels into the ground, but she was no match for the inexorable tug of his hand. She stumbled slightly, then found herself mere inches away from him. The air suddenly felt hot, very hot, and Sophie had the bizarre sense that she no longer quite knew how to work her hands and feet. Her skin tingled, her heart raced, and the bloody man was just staring at her, not moving a muscle, not pulling her the final few inches against him. Just staring at her.
"Benedict,"
she whispered, forgetting that she still called him Mr. Bridgerton. He smiled. It was a small, knowing sort of smile, one that sent chills right down her spine to another area altogether.
"I like when you say my name," he said.
"I didn't mean to,"
she admitted. He touched a finger to her lips.
"Shh," he admonished. "Don't tell me that. Don't you know that's not what a man wishes to hear?"
"I don't have much experience with men," she said.
"Now that's what a man wishes to hear."
"Really?"
she asked dubiously. She knew men wanted innocence in their wives, but Benedict wasn't about to marry a girl like her. He touched her cheek with one fingertip.
"It's what I want to hear from you."
A soft rush of air crossed Sophie's lips as she gasped. He was going to kiss her.
He was going to kiss her. It was the most wonderful and awful thing that could possibly happen. But oh, how she wanted this.
She knew she was going to regret this tomorrow.
She let out a smothered, choking sort of laugh. Who was she kidding? She'd regret it in 10 minutes. But she had spent the last 2 years remembering what it felt like to be in his arms, and she wasn't sure she'd make it through the rest of her days without at least one more memory to keep her going. His finger floated across her cheek to her temple, and then from there traced her eyebrow, ruffling the soft hairs as it moved to the bridge of her nose. "So pretty," he said softly, "like a storybook fairy. Sometimes I think you couldn't possibly be real." Her only reply was a quickening of breath. "I think I'm going to kiss you," he whispered.
"You think?"
"I think I have to kiss you," he said, looking as if he couldn't quite believe his own words. "It's rather like breathing. One doesn't have much choice in the matter." Benedict's kiss was achingly tender. His lips brushed across hers in a feather-light caress, back and forth, with just the barest hint of friction. It was utterly breathtaking. But there was something more, something that made her dizzy and weak. Sophie clutched at his shoulders, wondering why she felt so off balance and strange. And then it suddenly came to her. It was just like before. The way his lips brushed hers, so soft and sweet, the way he began with gentle titillation, rather than forcing entry, it was just what he'd done at the masquerade. After 2 years of dreams, Sophie was finally reliving the single most exquisite moment of her life. "You're crying," Benedict said, touching her cheek. Sophie blinked, then reached up to wipe away the tears she hadn't even known were falling. "Do you want me to stop?" he whispered. She shook her head. No, she didn't want him to stop. She wanted him to kiss her just as he had at the masquerade, the gentle caress giving way to a more passionate joining. And then she wanted him to kiss her some more, because this time the clock wasn't going to strike midnight, and she wouldn't have to flee. And she wanted him to know that she was the woman from the masquerade, and she desperately prayed that he would never recognize her. And she was just so bloody confused, and he kissed her, really kissed her, with fierce lips and probing tongue, and all the passion and desire a woman could ever want. He made her feel beautiful, precious, priceless. He treated her like a woman, not some serving wench. And until that very moment, she hadn't realized just how much she missed being treated like a person. Gentry and aristocrats didn't see their servants. They tried not to hear them. And when they were forced to converse, they kept it as short and perfunctory as possible. But when Benedict kissed her, she felt real. And when he kissed her, he did so with his entire body. His lips, which had begun the intimacy with such gentle reverence, were now fierce and demanding on hers. His hands, so large and strong they seemed to cover half her back, held her to him with a strength that left her breathless. And his body, dear God, it ought to be illegal the way it was pressed against hers, the heat of it seeping through her clothing, searing her very soul. He made her shiver. He made her melt. He made her want to give herself to him, something she'd sworn she would never do outside the sacrament of marriage. "Oh, Sophie," he murmured, his voice husky against her lips. "I've never felt..." Sophie stiffened, because she was fairly certain he'd intended to say he'd never felt that way before, and she had no idea how she felt about that. On the one hand, it was thrilling to be the one woman who could bring him to his knees, make him dizzy with desire and need. On the other hand, he'd kissed her before. Hadn't he felt the same exquisite torture then, too? Dear God, was she jealous of herself? He pulled back a half inch. "What's wrong?" She gave her head a little shake.
"Nothing."
Benedict touched his fingers to the tip of her chin and tilted her face up. "Don't lie to me, Sophie.
What's wrong?
I'm only nervous, she stammered. That's all.
His eyes narrowed with concerned suspicion. Are you certain?
Absolutely certain.
She tugged herself from his grasp and took a few steps away from him, her arms hugging over her chest.
I don't do this sort of thing, you know.
Benedict watched her walk away, studying the bleak line of her back. I know, he said softly. You're not the sort of girl who would. She gave a little laugh at that, and even though he could not see her face, he could well imagine its expression.
How do you know that?
She asked. It's obvious in everything you do. She didn't turn around. She didn't say anything. And then, before he had any idea what he was saying, the most bizarre question tumbled from his mouth. Who are you, Sophie? He asked. Who are you, really? She still didn't turn around, and when she spoke, her voice was barely above a whisper.
What do you mean?
Something isn't quite right about you, he said. You speak too well to be a maid. Her hand was nervously fidgeting with the folds of her skirt as she said,
Is it a crime to wish to speak well? One can't get very far in this country with a low-born accent.
One could make the argument, he said with deliberate softness, that you haven't gotten very far. Her arms straightened into sticks, straight, rigid sticks, with little tight fists at the end. And then, while he waited for her to say something, she started walking away. Wait! He called out, and he caught up with her in under three strides, grabbing hold of her wrist. He tugged at her, until she was forced to turn around. Don't go, he said.
It is not my habit to remain in the company of people who insult me.
Benedict nearly flinched, and he knew he would be forever haunted by the stricken look in her eyes. I wasn't insulting you, he said, and you know it. I was speaking the truth. You're not meant to be a housemaid, Sophie. It's clear to me, and it ought to be clear to you. She laughed, a hard, brittle sound he'd never thought to hear from her.
And what do you suggest I do, Mr. Bridgerton? She asked. Find work as a governess?
Benedict thought that was a fine idea, and he started to tell her so. But she interrupted him, saying,
And who do you think will hire me?
Well,
no one, she snapped. No one will hire me. I have no references, and I look far too young.
And pretty, he said grimly. He'd never given much thought to the hiring of governesses, but he knew that the duty usually fell to the mother of the house. And common sense told him that no mother wanted to bring such a pretty young thing into her household. Just look what Sophie had had to endure at the hands of Philip Cavender. You could be a lady's maid, he suggested. At least then you wouldn't be cleaning chamber pots.
You'd be surprised, she muttered.
A companion to an elderly lady? She sighed. It was a sad, weary sound, and it nearly broke his heart.
You're very kind to try to help me, she said, but I have already explored all of those avenues. Besides, I am not your responsibility.
You could be. She looked at him in surprise. In that moment, Benedict knew that he had to have her. There was a connection between them, a strange, inexplicable bond that he'd felt only one other time in his life with the mystery lady from the masquerade. And while she was gone, vanished into thin air, Sophie was very real. He was tired of mirages. He wanted someone he could see, someone he could touch. And she needed him. She might not realize it yet, but she needed him. Benedict took her hand and tugged, catching her off balance and wrapping her to him when she fell against his body.
Mr. Bridgerton,
she yelped. Benedict, he corrected, his lips at her ear.
Let me...
Say my name, he persisted. He could be very stubborn when it suited his interests, and he wasn't going to let her go until he heard his name cross her lips, and maybe not even then.
Benedict,
she finally relented.
I...
Hush. He silenced her with his mouth, nibbling at the corner of her lips. When she went soft and compliant in his arms, he drew back, just far enough so that he could focus on her eyes. They looked impossibly green in the late afternoon light, deep enough to drown in. "I want you to come back to London with me," he whispered, the words tumbling forth before he had a chance to consider them. "Come back and live with me." She looked at him in surprise. "Be mine," he said, his voice thick and urgent. "Be mine right now. Be mine forever. I'll give you anything you want. All I want in return is you."
Chapter 12. Speculation continues to abound concerning the disappearance of Benedict Bridgerton. According to Eloise Bridgerton, who, as his sister ought to know, he was due back in town several days ago. But as Eloise must be the first to admit, a man of Mr. Bridgerton's age and stature need hardly report his whereabouts to his younger sister. Lady Whistledown's Society Papers, 9th of May, 1817.
"You want me to be your mistress?" she said flatly.
He gave her a confused look, although she couldn't be sure whether that was because her statement was so obvious or because he objected to her choice of words.
"I want you to be with me," he persisted.
The moment was so staggeringly painful, and yet she found herself almost smiling.
"How is that different from being your mistress?"
"Sophie,
how is it different?"
she repeated, her voice growing strident.
"I don't know, Sophie."
He sounded impatient.
"Does it matter?"
"It does to me."
"Fine," he said in a short voice. "Fine. Be my mistress. And have this."
Sophie had just enough time to gasp before his lips descended on hers with a ferocity that turned her knees to water. It was like no kiss they'd ever shared, harsh with need and laced with an odd, strange anger. His mouth devoured hers in a primitive dance of passion. His hands seemed to be everywhere, on her breasts, around her waist, even under her skirt. He touched and squeezed, caressed and stroked, and all the while he had her pressed up so tightly against him, she was certain she'd melt into his skin.
"I want you,"
he said roughly, his lips finding the hollow at the base of her throat.
"I want you right now. I want you here."
"Benedict."
"I want you in my bed," he growled. "I want you tomorrow, and I want you the next day."
She was wicked, and she was weak, and she gave in to the moment, arching her neck to allow him greater access. His lips felt so good against her skin, sending shivers and tingles to the very centre of her being. He made her long for him, long for all the things she couldn't have, and curse the things she could. And then somehow she was on the ground, and he was there with her, half on and half off of her body. He seemed so large, so powerful, and in that moment, so perfectly hers. A very small part of Sophie's mind was still functioning, and she knew that she had to say no, had to put a stop to the madness. But God help her, she couldn't. Not yet. She'd spent so long dreaming about him, trying desperately to remember the scent of his skin, the sound of his voice. There had been many nights when the fantasy of him had been all that had kept her company. She had been living on dreams, and she wasn't a woman for whom many had come true. She didn't want to lose this one just yet.
"Benedict,"
she murmured, touching the crisp silkiness of his hair and pretending that he hadn't just asked her to be his mistress, that she was someone else, anyone else, anyone but the bastard daughter of a dead earl, with no means of support besides waiting on others. Her murmuring seemed to embolden him, and his hand, which had been tickling her knee for so long, started to inch upward, squeezing the soft skin of her thigh. Years of hard work had made her lean, not fashionably curvy, but he didn't seem to mind. In fact, she could feel his heart begin to beat even more rapidly, hear his breath coming in hoarser gasps.
"Sophie, Sophie, Sophie,"
he groaned, his lips moving frantically along her face, until they found her mouth again.
I need you.
He pressed his hips hotly against hers.
Do you feel how I need you?
I need you too,
she whispered. And she did. There was a fire burning within her that had been simmering quietly for years. The sight of him had ignited it anew, and his touch was like kerosene, sending her into a conflagration. His fingers wrestled with the large, poorly made buttons on the back of her dress.
I'm going to burn this, he grunted,
his other hand relentlessly stroking the tender skin at the back of her knee.
I'll dress you in silks, in satins.
He moved to her ear, nipping at her lobe, then licking the tender skin where her ear met her cheek.
I'll dress you in nothing at all.
Sophie stiffened in his arms. He'd managed to say the one thing that could remind her why she was here, why he was kissing her. It wasn't love or any of those tender emotions she'd dreamed about, but lust. And he wanted to make her a kept woman, just as her mother had been. Oh, God, it was so tempting, so impossibly tempting. He was offering her a life of ease and luxury, a life with him, at the price of her soul. No, that wasn't entirely true, or entirely a problem. She might be able to live as a man's mistress. The benefits, and how could she consider life with Benedict anything but a benefit, might outweigh the drawbacks. But while she might be willing to make such decisions with her own life and reputation, she would not do so for a child. And how could there not be a child? All mistresses eventually had children. With a tortured cry, she gave him a shove and wrenched herself away, rolling to the side until she found herself on her hands and knees, stopping to catch her breath before hauling herself to her feet.
I can't do this, Benedict, she said, barely able to look at him.
I don't see why not, he muttered.
I can't be your mistress.
He rose to his feet.
And why is that?
Something about him pricked at her. Maybe it was the arrogance of his tone. Maybe it was the insolence in his posture.
Because I don't want to,
she snapped. His eyes narrowed, not with suspicion, but with anger.
You wanted to just a few seconds ago.
You're not being fair, she said in a low voice. I wasn't thinking.
His chin jutted out belligerently.
You're not supposed to be thinking. That's the point of it.
She blushed as she redid her buttons. He'd done a very good job of making her not think. She'd almost thrown away a lifetime of vows and morals, all at one wicked kiss.
Well, I won't be your mistress, she said again.
Maybe if she said it enough, she'd feel more confident that he wouldn't be able to break down her defences.
And what are you going to do instead? He hissed. Work as a housemaid?
If I have to.
You'd rather wait on people, polish their silver, scrub out their damned chamber pots, than come and live with me?
She said only one word, but it was low and true. Yes. His eyes flashed furiously.
I don't believe you. No one would make that choice.
I did.
You're a fool.
She said nothing.
Do you understand what you're giving up?
He persisted, his arm waving wildly as he spoke. She'd hurt him, she realized. She'd hurt him and insulted his pride, and he was lashing out like a wounded bear. Sophie nodded, even though he wasn't looking at her face.
I could give you whatever you wanted, he bit off. Clothes? Jewels? Hell, forget about the clothes and jewels. I could give you a bloody roof over your head, which is more than you have now.
That is true, she said quietly.
He leaned forward, his eyes burning hot into hers.
I could give you everything.
Somehow, she managed to stand up straight. And somehow she managed not to cry. And somehow she even managed to keep her voice even, as she said,
If you think that's everything, then you probably wouldn't understand why I must refuse.
She took a step back, intending to head to his cottage and pack her meagre bag. But he obviously wasn't through with her yet. because he stopped her with a strident, "Where are you going?"
"Back to the cottage," she said, "to pack my bag."
"And where do you think you're going to go with that bag?"
Her mouth fell open. Surely he didn't expect her to stay.
"Do you have a job?" he demanded. "A place to go?"
"No," she replied. "But..." He planted his hands on his hips and glared at her.
"And you think I'm going to just let you leave here, with no money or prospects?"
Sophie was so surprised, she started to blink uncontrollably. "Well," she stammered, "I didn't think..."
"No, you didn't think," he snapped.
She just stared at him, eyes wide and lips parted, unable to believe what she was hearing.
"You bloody fool," he swore. "Do you have any idea how dangerous it is in the world for a woman alone?"
Yes, she managed. "Actually, I do." If he heard her, he gave no indication, just went on about men who take advantage, and helpless women, and fate's worse than death. Sophie wasn't positive, but she thought she even heard the phrase roast beef and pudding. About halfway through his tirade, she lost all ability to focus on his words. She just kept watching his mouth and hearing the tone of his voice, all the while trying to comprehend the fact that he seemed remarkably concerned for her welfare, considering that she'd just summarily rejected him.
"Are you even listening to a word I'm saying?" Benedict demanded.
Sophie didn't nod or shake her head, instead doing an odd combination of both. Benedict swore under his breath.
"That's it," he announced. "You're coming back to London with me."
That seemed to wake her up.
"I just said I'm not."
"You don't have to be my damned mistress," he bit off. "But I'm not leaving you to fend for yourself."
"I was fending for myself quite adequately before I met you."
"Adequately?" he sputtered. "At the Cavenders? You call that adequate?"
"You're not being fair."
"And you're not being intelligent."
Benedict thought that his argument was most reasonable, if a little overbearing, but Sophie obviously did not agree, because, much to his surprise, he found himself lying face up on the ground, having been felled by a remarkably quick right hook.
"Don't you ever call me stupid," she hissed.
Benedict blinked, trying to get his eyesight back to the point where he only saw one of her.
"I wasn't."
"Yes, you were," she replied in a low, angry voice.
Then she turned on her heel, and in the split second before she stalked away, he realized he had only one way to stop her. He certainly wasn't going to make it to his feet with anything resembling speed in his current befuddled state, so he reached out and grabbed one of her ankles with both of his hands, sending her sprawling onto the ground right next to him. It wasn't a particularly gentlemanly manoeuvre, but beggars really couldn't be choosers, and besides, she had thrown the first punch.
"You're not going anywhere," he growled.
Sophie slowly lifted her head, spitting out dirt as she glared at him.
"I cannot believe," she said scathingly, "that you just did that."
Benedict let go of her foot and hauled himself to a crouching position.
"Believe it."
"You..."
He held up a hand.
"Don't say anything now, I beg you."
Her eyes bugged out.
"You're begging me?"
"I hear your voice," he informed her. "Therefore you must be speaking."
"But..."
"And as for begging you,"
he said, effectively cutting her off again,
"I assure you it was merely a figure of speech."
She opened her mouth to say something, then obviously thought the better of it, clamping her lips shut with a petulant look of a 3-year-old. Benedict let out a short breath, then offered her his hand. She was, after all, still sitting in the dirt, and not looking especially happy about it. She stared at his hand with remarkable revulsion, then moved her gaze to his face and glared at him with such ferocity that Benedict wondered if he had recently sprouted horns. Still not saying a word, she ignored his offer of help and hefted herself to her feet.
"As you like," he murmured.
"A poor choice of words,"
she snapped,
then started marching away. As Benedict was on his feet this time, he felt no need to incapacitate her. Instead, he dogged her every step, remaining a mere, and annoying he was sure, 2 paces behind her. Finally, after about a minute, she turned around and said,
"Please leave me alone."
"I'm afraid I can't," he said.
"Can't or won't?"
He thought about that for a moment.
"Can't."
She scowled at him and kept walking.
"I find it as difficult to believe as you do,"
Benedict called out, keeping pace with her. She stopped and turned around.
"That is impossible."
"I can't help it," he said with a shrug. "I find myself completely unwilling to let you go."
"Unwilling is a far cry from can't."
"I didn't save you from Cavender just to let you squander your life away."
"That isn't your choice to make."
She had a point there, but he wasn't inclined to give it to her.
"Perhaps," he allowed, "but I'm going to make it anyway. You're coming with me to London. We will discuss it no further."
"You're trying to punish me," she said,
"because I refused you."
"No," he said slowly, considering her words even as he answered.
"No, I'm not. I'd like to punish you. And in my current state of mind, I'd even go so far as to say you deserve to be punished. But that's not why I'm doing it."
"Then why are you?"
"It's for your own good."
"That's the most condescending, patronizing—"
"I'm sure you're right," he allowed. "But nonetheless, in this particular case, at this particular moment, I know what's best for you, and you clearly don't. So don't hit me again," he warned.
Sophie looked down at her fist, which she hadn't even realized was pulled back and ready to fly. He was turning her into a monster. There was no other explanation. She didn't think she'd ever hit anyone in her life, and here she was, ready to do it for the second time that day. Eyes never leaving her hand, she slowly unclenched her fist, stretching her fingers out like a starfish and holding them there for the count of 3.
"How," she said in a very low voice, "do you intend to stop me from going my way?"
"Does it really matter?" he asked, shrugging nonchalantly. "I'm sure I'll think of something."
Her mouth fell open.
"Are you saying you'd tie me up and—"
"I didn't say anything of the sort," he cut in with a wicked grin. "But the idea certainly has its charms."
"You are despicable," she spat.
"And you sound like the heroine of a very poorly written novel," he replied. "What did you say you were reading this morning?"
Sophie felt the muscles working frenetically in her cheek, felt her jaw clenching to the point where she was certain her teeth would shatter. How Benedict managed to be the most wonderful and the most awful man in the world at the very same time, she would never understand. Right now, though, the awful side seemed to be winning. And she was quite certain, logic aside, that if she remained in his company one more second, her head would explode.
"I'm leaving,"
she said, with, in her opinion, great drama and resolve. But he just answered her with a sly half-smile and said,
"I'm following."
And the bloody man remained 2 strides behind her the entire way home. Benedict didn't often go out of his way to annoy people, with the notable exception of his siblings, but Sophie Beckett clearly brought out the devil in him. He stood in the doorway to her room as she packed, casually lounging against the doorframe. His arms were crossed in a manner that he somehow knew would vex her, and his right leg was slightly bent, the toe of his boot stubbed up against the floor.
"Don't forget your dress," he said helpfully.
She glared at him.
"The ugly one,"
he added, as if clarification were necessary.
"They're both ugly,"
she spat out. "Ah, a reaction."
"I know."
She went back to shoving her belongings into her satchel. He waved an arm expansively.
"Feel free to take a souvenir."
She straightened, her hands planted angrily on her hips.
"Does that include the silver tea service? Because I could live for several years on what that would fetch."
"You may certainly take the tea service," he replied genially, "as you will not be out of my company."
"I will not be your mistress," she hissed. "I told you I won't do it. I can't do it."
Something about her use of the word "can't" struck him as significant. He mulled that over for a few moments while she gathered up the last of her belongings and cinched shut the drawstring to her satchel.
"That's it,"
he murmured. She ignored him, instead marching toward the door and giving him a pointed look. He knew she wanted him to get out of the way so she could depart. He didn't move a muscle, save for one finger that thoughtfully stroked the side of his jaw.
"You're illegitimate," he said.
The blood drained from her face.
"You are,"
he said, more to himself than to her. Strangely, he felt rather relieved by the revelation. It explained her rejection of him, made it into something that had nothing to do with him and everything to do with her. It took the sting out.
"I don't care if you're illegitimate,"
he said, trying not to smile. It was a serious moment, but by God, he wanted to break out in a grin, because now she'd come to London with him and be his mistress. There were no more obstacles, and...
"You don't understand anything,"
she said, shaking her head.
"It's not about whether I'm good enough to be your mistress."
"I would care for any children we might have,"
he said solemnly, pushing himself away from the doorframe. Her stance grew even more rigid, if that were possible.
"And what about your wife?"
"I don't have a wife."
"Ever?"
He froze. A vision of the masquerade lady danced through his mind. He'd pictured her many ways. Sometimes she wore her silver ball gown, sometimes nothing at all. Sometimes she wore a wedding dress. Sophie's eyes narrowed as she watched his face. Then she snorted derisively as she stalked past him. He followed.
"That's not a fair question, Sophie,"
he said, dogging her heels. She moved down the hall, not even pausing when she reached the stairs.
"I think it's more than fair."
He raced down the stairs until he was below her, halting her progress.
"I have to marry someday."
Sophie stopped. She had to. He was blocking her path.
"Yes, you do," she said. "But I don't have to be anyone's mistress."
"Who was your father, Sophie?"
"I don't know,"
she lied.
"Who was your mother?"
"She died at my birth."
"I thought you said she was a housekeeper."
"Clearly I misrepresented the truth,"
she said, past the point of caring that she'd been caught in a lie.
"Where did you grow up?"
"It's of no interest," she said, trying to squirm her way past him.
One of his hands wrapped itself around her upper arm, holding her firmly in place.
"I find it very interesting."
"Let me go!"
Her cry pierced the silence of the hall, loud enough so that the Crabtrees would certainly come running to save her. Except that Mrs. Crabtree had gone to the village, and Mr. Crabtree was outside, out of earshot. There was no one to help her, and she was at his mercy.
"I can't let you go," he whispered. "You're not cut out for a life of servitude. It will kill you."
"If it were going to kill me,"
she returned,
"it would have done so years ago."
"But you don't have to do this any longer," he persisted.
"Don't you dare try to make this about me,"
she said, nearly shaking with emotion.
"You're not doing this out of concern for my welfare. You just don't like being thwarted."
"That is true," he admitted. "But I also won't see you cast adrift."
"I have been adrift all my life,"
she whispered, and she felt the traitorous sting of tears prick her eyes. God above, she didn't want to cry in front of this man. Not now, not when she felt so off balance and weak. He touched her chin.
"Let me be your anchor."
Sophie closed her eyes. His touch was painfully sweet, and a not very small part of her was aching to accept his offer, to leave the life she'd been forced to live, and cast her lot with him, this marvellous, wonderful, infuriating man who had haunted her dreams for years. But the pain of her childhood was still too fresh, and the stigma of her illegitimacy felt like a brand on her soul. She would not do this to another child.
"I can't," she whispered. "I wish..."
"What do you wish?" he asked urgently. She shook her head. She'd been about to tell him that she wished that she could, but she knew that such words would be unwise. He would only latch onto them and press his cause anew, and that would make it all the harder to say no.
"You leave me no choice, then," he stated grimly.
Her eyes met his.
"Either you come with me to London, and..."
He held up a silencing hand when she tried to protest.
"And I will find you a position in my mother's household,"
he added pointedly.
"Or?"
she asked, her voice sullen.
"Or I will have to inform the magistrate that you have stolen from me."
Her mouth abruptly tasted like acid.
"You wouldn't," she whispered.
"I certainly don't want to."
"But you would."
He nodded.
"I would."
"They'd hang me," she said. "Or send me to Australia."
"Not if I requested otherwise."
"And what would you request?"
His brown eyes looked strangely flat, and she suddenly realized that he wasn't enjoying the conversation any more than she was.
"I would request," he said, "that you be released into my custody."
"That would be very convenient for you."
His fingers, which had been touching her chin all the while, slid down to her shoulder.
"I'm only trying to save you from yourself."
Sophie walked to a nearby window and looked out, surprised that he hadn't tried to stop her.
"You're making me hate you, you know," she said.
"I can live with that."
She gave him a curt nod.
"I will wait for you in the library, then. I would like to leave today."
Benedict watched her walk away, stood utterly still as the door to the library closed behind her. He knew she would not flee. She was not the sort to go back on her word. He couldn't let this one go. She had left, the great and mysterious she, he thought with a bitter smile, the one woman who had touched his heart, the same woman who had not even given him her name. But now there was Sophie, and she did things to him, things he hadn't felt since her. He was sick of pining for a woman who practically didn't exist. Sophie was here, and Sophie would be his. And, he thought with grim determination, Sophie was not going to leave him.
"I can live with you hating me," he said to the closed door. "I just can't live without you."
Chapter 13. It was previously reported in this column that this author predicted a possible match between Miss Rosamund Riling and Mr. Philip Cavender. This author can now say that this is not likely to occur. Lady Penwood, Miss Riling's mother, has been heard to say that she will not settle for a mere mister, even though Miss Riling's father, while certainly well-born, was not a member of the aristocracy. Not to mention, of course, that Mr. Cavender has begun to show a decided interest in Miss Cressida Cooper. Lady Whistledown's Society Papers, 9th of May, 1817. Sophie started feeling ill the minute the carriage departed my cottage. By the time they stopped for the night at an inn in Oxfordshire, she was downright queasy. And when they reached the outskirts of London, well, she was quite convinced she would throw up. Somehow, she managed to keep the contents of her stomach where they belonged, but as their carriage wended farther into the tangled streets of London, she was filled with an intense sense of apprehension. No, not apprehension. Doom. It was May, which meant that the season was in full swing, which meant that Araminta was in residence, which meant that Sophie's arrival was a bad, bad idea.
"Very bad," she muttered.
Benedict looked up.
"Did you say something?"
She crossed her arms mutinously.
just that you're a very bad man."
He chuckled. She'd known he would chuckle, and it still irritated her. He pulled the curtain away from the window and looked out. "We're nearly there," he said. He'd said that he was taking her directly to his mother's residence.